91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we visit with philosopher and author Dr. Christopher Phillips and discuss his latest work, The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Phillips takes a different approach to the traditional boundaries between childhood and adulthood to reveal how rather than lapse into adulthood, we can achieve all-round excellence when we look to children and youth as an aid to our development. Phillips is the founder of the worldwide Socrates Cafe Gatherings. Childhood is the launching pad of life when learning is most intense. He says it's important for us to maintain the qualities of childhood and stave off mental and emotional shrinking. So stay with us. Your calls are welcome. First, the news. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, it's today's Topical Currents. Today we visit with author, philosopher, educator, and founder of the global Socrates Cafe movement, Dr. Christopher Phillips. The topic today is termed childing and how adults grow out of the important values and creativity of our early years.
His latest book is The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. And because of his worldwide cafe efforts, he's been called the Johnny Appleseed of philosophy. He's written four philosophy-themed books as well as two works for children.
Dr. Christopher Phillips joins us now in the studio. Welcome to you, Christopher Phillips.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thanks.
Well, there's a lot to talk about, but before we get into the book and childing even, when you say how we can, you know, cull these things through the wisdom of our youngest, what ages are we talking about?
I'm talking young.
You're talking about just getting verbal?
I'm talking about from the minute they're born.
Okay.
Those personalities, I realize, have already been developing for a long time. But there's this sense that, oh, they're needy. But, you know, those in the community or just within the family group who raised them, well, we're needy too. And you see this, You can almost use them like touchstones. You start to sort of slow down life and meditate a little bit. I'd lived this ridiculously intensive life until my first child was born. And suddenly I rejected it, and I just wanted to stare at my child. And it was this kind of this epiphany about why did I bring her into the world at a time when there's so much polarization, craziness, and what can I do, what must I do? It brought a lot of questions to the forefront. But it was because of these this miracle of birth that I sort of became transformed.
Because you had children now, because you've been doing this for an awfully long time, well before you ever even thought of having.
I did,
a child.
And you know, I mean, nothing was ever asked of me. I'm a kid who's was raised at a time when didn't even have to register for the draft or anything. I mean, our big siren song was, you got to fight for the right to party. This was Newport News, Virginia, in the height of the desegregation era. So I don't know. I somehow, against the odds, sort of inculcated the social conscience. I think it came a lot from having a mother who was this exceptional listener who raised me to believe that you know, you don't live just for yourself. Having a Greek grandmother, I spent my summers in Florida, Yaya, who told me about this Greek concept called arete, which I now have tattooed on my arm, which means a sort of all-around excellence in which duty to self and others goes hand in glove. So those things spoke to me at a really young age. Did I ever think I'd be sort of Socrates in the streets? No. But at a time when Americans were so deeply polarized in the 1996, in the height of the when Clinton was undergoing impeachment proceedings, I decided, you know, I have to start walking the walk a little bit and quit pointing the finger at others for why we're so polarized and why we're just screaming and yelling at each other. And I harked back to this kind of inquiry rather than argument, an inquiry with a heart where we really do try to open ourselves up to alien and novel points of view as a way of even if we leave more entrenched in an inquiry than ever, at the end than at the outset, the idea is that at least you listen to somebody for a while. And that in itself can be transformed. Of course, today, here we are in 2017, and we've all come together as one.
Have we? Yeah. Okay, so you spend a lot of time going over the concept of childing. It's nothing new. It's a 13th century notion, but let's go over that. What is it, and what do you mean by it? Mm-hmm.
Well, the idea, actually, and again, I owe the royalties for this book, I think, to this group of elementary school kids where I held a dialogue in Iowa. And we were talking at one point. We were riffing about which came first, the chicken or the egg. And then suddenly they said, they started bringing it over to humans. And they said, one child said, well, you never hear us talk about childing. We only talk about parenting. And another kid said, well, we should have a word called childing because there wouldn't be parents without children. And children do raise parents. And so I did some gumshoe work after that, and lo and behold, there was a word called childing that had been in the human lexicon since the mid-13th century. And typically translates to a new cluster of blossoms growing around an older cluster. And I thought, well, if we apply that concept to the human sphere, it means that we don't shed the old as we accrue the new. So we darn well better make sure that we flourish from a healthy core at the outset. And that just led to a whole host of questions. Well, why is it that the latest studies show that kids have very unique and singular reasoning skills at empathy at a very young age, which typically we adults don't detect? Why is it that they can frame questions better than adults quite often? I think a lot of it feeds into their ability to see the world holistically, to learn so many languages at a very young age, which creates types of understanding that we older folks lack.
You mentioned in the book that impoverished children tend to have a very high level of compassion and reactions to human suffering, much more than adults.
And it's been really revelatory for me. My wife and I spend a lot of time holding dialogues with children in Chiapas, Mexico. My wife's Mexican, and she had been a teacher in an indigenous community there, and we hold Classroom Without Walls. They will share everything they have with anyone they feel is in need of something, not just with their families, but there is that giving spirit and ethos that puts so many of us from the Western world, like me, brought up in a certain sensibility to shame almost. So every time I really engage with them, not in a hierarchical way, but just as Chris, asking questions, and when I have a healthy dose of humility, which isn't always the case, but suddenly I open myself up to the possibility of being transformed by their insights, because they have amazing insights. I had one inquiry with indigenous kids on what is a true human being, and they said, and they told me about their beliefs, that you're born in the world as a human being, but to become a true human being, you have to demonstrate certain acts and deeds. And I asked her, what would be a way? And they goes, well, and one of the children, a 12-year-old child from Chiapas who can't read, never has a chance to go to school, and sells her beautiful hand-woven goods 16 hours a day in the streets, said, well, a true human being is someone, when I try to sell her something, doesn't, at least says no, or even better, says no thank you.
Instead of just ignores them.
Or pushing them over. They've been pushed like they're invisible. And I said, well, why does that make you true, that person a true human being? Because she acknowledged me. She recognized me as a fellow human being.
One thing I think is interesting, you know, you say our identity becomes more blurry as we grow, as we get older, not necessarily grow, but as we get older. But isn't it supposed to be more crystalline? I mean, aren't we supposed to know who we are? And, you know, what are you referring to when you say our identity becomes more blurry?
I think it can become more blurry as we just start living in the hurly-burly of everyday life, and we're trying to make ends meet, and we don't have a chance to think too much about who we are and what we still want to be. And I think that by having inquiries maybe once a week or once every couple of weeks, and having kids in that orbit in those inquiries, can bring us back to, well, why are we here? And even if we don't have a great deal of time, what can I still do to make sure that I become somebody that my child or some children in my orbit would be proud to know? Hopefully, ideally, my view is there were always sort of sculptures in the making, works in progress. But that's a tall order at a time when it's just expensive to make ends meet. I do make the argument, and I've been making it since I began the first Socrates Cafe over 20 years ago, that by taking pause a couple of hours a week to just inquire with others, there's a meditative aspect to that. And without forcing it or proselytizing, just by having an inquiry with other thoughtful human beings of lots of ages and walks of life, we just naturally begin asking ourselves again, well, what can I still do? It doesn't have to be some great grandiose transformation. It could just be inquiring with other people and thinking about those things and maybe being a little more cognizant of how our actions do impact others.
Something that struck me in the book was the notion that we don't need to coach or teach morality to children.
Well, at the very least, I think it has to be mini-directional. Quite often, the biggest sophisticates of coaching empathy, like Daniel Goleman and social intelligence, whom I respect them deeply, but it's typically all about the adult setting the example.
Right.
At the very best, if they're most progressive, it's adult at least has to set the example. But to actually recognize how empathetic a young person can be is an act that many adults just aren't willing to take. And yet I've seen it again and again. And they'll say to me, well, come on now. I've seen cacophony at its finest when kids inquire. I say, that's because they're not used to being listened to. Give them a break. Listen to them. Get in the habit of letting them know that you can listen to them. And all of a sudden, you'll see that they open themselves up and enthusiastically embrace a variety of perspectives in a way an adult can't or won't.
You know, you point out the irony, and it is ironic, that the world has never been more child-centric in terms of, the kid is already going to college. They pick the college when the kid is 3 years old now, and the helicopter parents and all that. But on the other hand, you say children's spontaneity has never been more endangered, and they've never been more strained and pinched, is the way you put it. And so that is ironic, because we think that children, are the mm-hmm. focus of everything, but you're saying that's not the case.
The overscheduled child is the bane of human existence so often in my orbit these days.
Oh, okay. Well, can we get back to that?
We talk?
Okay. We're speaking with Dr. Christopher Phillips. He's an author, philosopher, scholar, educator, specialist in the Socratic method, which we also want to explain when we get back. His latest book is The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. We'll be right back.
And we're back with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're visiting with Dr. Christopher Phillips. His latest book is The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. If you'd like to join in with a comment or questions, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or also email radio@wlrn.org. Please keep them simple, radio@wlrn.org.
So we were talking about children being overscheduled and how that's impinging on their spontaneity.
I think that I became a dad at 47 and then again at 54. So I have a 3-year-old and a 10-year-old. And I know how easy it is to just schedule lots of things for them. But if they don't have that blessed time that I had to just wonder and wander. And sometimes I worry about the wandering part, because it's not like it used to be.
No.
When you could go off in the woods and not worry about things. Or if there's any woods left, my goodness gracious, they keep just tearing
right.
them apart. So, but it's if they don't have a chance to, there's this thing about just being a child. And by that, I think it's just to explore and think and wonder without, if adults are part of the scene, that at the very least that they don't try to foist things on them and just let them be. And maybe you as an adult open yourself up to their world of wonder. I think that could be, you would leave unscathed, not unscathed in the best sense of the term. You too would start retapping into that childlike sense of wonder.
Well, that's, the point of your book. Your book is not about parenting. It's not about raising children. It's really about how adults can tap into what we had. It reminded me, mm-hmm. did you ever read, are you familiar with Intimations of Immortality by William Wordsworth?
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, everybody, right. The philosophers forever have been right. breaking us into stages, mm-hmm. but Wordsworth had said, you know, that there are three stages. One is, you know, to be a child, then mm-hmm. we grow up, we become adolescent, then mm-hmm. we age. And then in the final stage, uh-huh. we retap or recapture mm-hmm. what we had as a child.
And I think that, many adults never had a chance to be children.
Right.
My dad's dad died when he was 7. So he had to start contributing to the family. He didn't have a chance to do childlike things till he retired at 69. And then suddenly you could see sort of this impish way he went about things, and this curiosity had always been brimming, but he just never had a chance.
Once a man, twice a boy.
Yes, but I think that quite often we look at adulthood as a state of being, and I argue this in the book, and that childhood is a state of becoming. Ideally, at every age and stage of life, even when we're frail and infirm, we have this opportunity to keep asking questions and becoming. It's amazing to me that the groups that we have at nursing homes and assisted living residences, the directors of events tell me that the people who never come to events come to the Socrates cafes that they hold. And why? Because it's not mindless. They get to actually use their minds and keep using that curiosity that's brimming inside.
Well, of course, so often the oldest people are, you know, you often hear people say they're just like children, you know, they're just like children, mm-hmm. the very old mm-hmm. I'm speaking of.
And typically when they say that, they mean like they're helpless like children. But what it should mean is that
right.
they're asking why with unflinching honesty and great curiosity in a way that they hadn't had a chance to do since they were children. And I argue that if we don't take time regularly to tap into those childlike qualities. We reason differently as adults. We are curious differently than we are when we're children. But if we don't keep cultivating those qualities, we lose something that's integral, I think, to the whole reason for human being.
Well, what is it that we lose? Because I was thinking, you know, you mentioned it. Most people are doing their best just to survive right now. I mean, making ends meet. And it's a pretty stressed out environment. So mm-hmm. why would they care about being able better to frame their questions or improve their reasoning mm-hmm. capabilities? What would change there about their lives?
Because if we don't care, then we're going to bring in another generation that's going to repeat the same vicious cycle. So we got to do it for our kids. So we've created a fast-paced form of brutal human, you know, of capitalism that marginalizes children and youth. And so if we adults don't get with the program and start learning to ask ourselves, is this really the best we can do on our watch, then I think there's huge repercussions to pay. I think that all of us who are adults, we have to have some semblance of a social conscience and try to create some sort of world in which we are much more inclusive of our younger brethren. I argue in my book that we should include teens as you're going to laugh, right? That as sort of equals in the civic enterprise, because their brains are so malleable. They're more open and wondrously skeptical than we are. And we need that kind of input. We need to join forces with kids and youth in ways that tap into our unique strengths and weaknesses. And if we do, my operating premise is that we'll all be the better for it. And that hopefully we'll actually create a world in which we don't have to just spend all of our waking hours making ends meet, because suddenly we'll be looking out for one another again in a way that we forgot how to do.
What about the question that kids hear over and over and over when they're growing up? What are you going to be when you grow up?
I'm still asking myself that. How about you?
Yeah.
You know, I did change my life radically at age 37 when I started Socrates Cafe. It took the suicide of a dear friend to lead me to break a lot of self-imposed barriers. But so this whole idea of what are you going to be hopefully is something, not in a frustrating way, but in an exhilarating way, we might still ask ourselves until the end. One of my favorite writers is Harriet Doerr, D-O-E-R-R. She became a novelist in her 80s. You know, she obviously had these great childhood memories and adolescent experiences that she suddenly said, you know what, I'm not going to be bone and groan everything that happened before. I'm just going to do it right now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Socrates Cafes, because okay. there are several in South Florida. You're here, in fact, for some of these events. They are in Boca Del Rey, West Palm Beach, Highland Beach, and Coral Gables.
Yes.
But I just thought, for those who may not be as familiar with mm-hmm. Socrates, just when you speak about him, Socratic mm-hmm. method, Socratizing, mm-hmm. if you could just...
Okay. We have a directory of hundreds of groups on our website at SocratesCafe.com. My grandiose plan had been to just start one group in 1996, and it just touched a chord with so many people that I realized I couldn't be Johnny on the Spot or some, you know, cult of personality where it had to be the Chris Phillips Show. So I began showing people how to latch on to this accessible but rigorous method of inquiry, where it's not enough to say what you think, but you got to say why you think what you think. And then let others scrutinize your point of view in an inquisitive but non-threatening way. And then open it up and see what others think and ask them why. With this idea that we don't have to bring anything to consensus or closure, but that the inquiry itself is one in which we all win just by simply opening ourselves up to a really wide variety of points of view. That's very much antithetical to the way it is today, where if you turn on any sort, so many of the so-called dialogue and exchange programs, people are just hammering each other.
Yeah.
It's all about one-upmanship, my view's better than yours, and they're not even listening to each other. There's so many courses in rhetoric and debate and persuasion, but there's no courses in inquiry, much less in listening. That's what the world needs now.
Yeah, I was thinking, I just lost my train of thought, but what it comes down to really, and what you're saying, is it's about listening not just to children, and not just to others, but even to our inner voice. I mean, it's about listening.
That's a great way of putting it. I wish I'd said that. I mean, it's in the old days of Greek, in the halcyon days of the Greek polis, they didn't separate, no more than a child would, our inner cosmos from our outer cosmos. It's not that they were blurred. It's just that it was whole. And so when I do say that we should listen to one another, I could almost add like a child, because there's no separation yet. We haven't broken things down into microscopic categories, much less hyper-microscopic categories like an academic would. And so I make the argument, and I've been accused of being really wacky, that we need to open up our research offices, academic areas, populate them with kids, not just for career interest day. Tell a kid what you're doing. Bring that 50-word down to a 5-cent word. Explain what you're doing, and guess what'll happen? They'll ask you a question that'll help enrich and enhance your inquiry. That's what they did with me. That's why I wrote this book. I was just at a conference in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and I made that point, and they actually insisted at their gathering next year that it include kids at the roundtables.
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking, we're so busy with answers, coming up with answers all the time, that we forget about asking questions.
Well, I think that the idea is to maybe think that once we do come up with an answer, that we haven't arrived at it once for all.
Right.
But that we use that as sort of a launching pad, like a kid would, as a springboard for a whole new host of questions to ask. Quite often, the idea as a parent is, well, I want to give my kid a firm foundation, so I don't want them to get too confused. And I just say, kids aren't confused. They love this endless questioning, not just as an end in itself, but because it can open new portals for inquiry that we adults quite often cower at.
What about when a child asks a question and that answer that you hear so often, because I said so?
And every parent has said, I'll never say that to my kids.
Oh, gosh, the things that I've said, I'll never say that I say. But, you know, they don't do it to be abrasive or precocious or anything. They do it because it's in their DNA, and we need to reintroduce it back into our adult DNA.
You want to take
Let's see. We'll go to
the first one.
Shelley in North Miami. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi, Shelley. Go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to ask. Our guest speaker here was saying how children are extremely empathetic. And how then do you explain bullying that can become extremely severe within children? And also, do you find that there's any connection between bullying in children and criminal activities within adults?
Well, probably the second part of your question is beyond my ken. But the first part is, well, children typically learn racism, bullying, from their adult betters. It's not something that typically is a child, that's innate in a child. It's something that they learn. It's something
that example about the child that didn't notice the color.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's my oldest daughter, Callie. Callie and I watched two different versions of Annie. The first one is Lily White, and then we watched the second one. She goes, "Daddy, this Annie's different." And I said, "How so?" She goes, "She's taller and skinnier." She just didn't even think about skin color. Adults obsess about skin color. You know, this human-invented concept of race and racism is something I think we desperately need to unlearn and certainly not model with kids. Am I saying kids are always angels? Am I creating some idyllic version of kids? Of course not. But I am saying that bullying typically is something that they learn. So it's really cool that adults are starting to look in the mirror and ask some hard questions. What can I do to set a better example for my children? And can I open myself up enough to really look at kids to set an example for me? And that's the harder part. That's something that I'm really strenuously try to assert with evidence from the latest pioneering neuroscience and cognitive science in my book.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that too. Thanks, Shelley. Does that help?
Thank you, yeah.
Okay. We're speaking with Dr. Christopher Phillips. His latest book is The Philosophy of Childing. Another break. We'll be right back.
And we're back with Dr. Christopher Phillips on today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Our telephone line, we have a few lines open. 1-800-743-9576. Also email radio@wlrn.org. Dr. Phillips, how do we tap into the unique capacities of children? What's the best way to go about it?
You know, I have to say that you can tap into this without being a parent. You can. I was happy as a childless husband until my wife said she wanted to have a baby. But it's one of these things where I think that we have to welcome kids in our orbit, at the very least, be more observant of them. Look at the way that they go through airports. You know, parents who drag them through, some of them drag them on leashes, for heaven's sakes.
the harness.
Kids somehow manage to transcend all of that, and they're suddenly, like my daughter, pretending she's in this, like if it's a blue carpet, pretending she's in this vast aquarium. You know, they just see things in ways that we lose our ability to, until unless we just sort of join them and look at things, and it brings the stress level down amazingly, but it also turns back on those imaginative lenses that often, all too often.
So observation is the answer.
Observation and absorption at one and the same time. Asking ourselves, I went to one book event, and a woman said afterwards, she goes, "When do we quit leaping? When do we quit leaping and bounding?" She goes, "I remember till I was about 11, I leapt and bounded, even to the restroom. And I just stopped." And she says, "I ask myself now why." And I said, "Well, why don't you start again?" And I wrote a blog on our childing.org site about what if we adults started leaping and bounding again throughout our workday?
We'd break our bones.
Above and beyond breaking our bones and putting chiropractors in great business, we would maybe after we got over the initial embarrassment, maybe it would be transformative in some way.
Maybe skipping.
Skipping, okay.
I went through a phase where I walked on my hands a lot, even in department stores, to my mother's embarrassment, and she'd see my feet going dum-ba-dum-ba-dum.
Yes, and parents get embarrassed. Get back down there. Quit doing that. And I'm thinking, now I just watch and appreciate. And now I need to get the chutzpah to start leaping and bounding. If I'm going to write about it, I got to walk the walk, right?
So your blog is childing.org.
Yes, childing.org.
And then you have the website, SocratesCafe.com.
Yes, I do.
So you weren't always this way. When you first started these inquiries, it was more as you were the teacher and they were the students, or they were the pupils, or
whatever.
That's right.
So it was transformative for me, too.
Right.
I come by this honestly. When I realized, and I had to sort of realize it grudgingly at first, that I was learning more from them than they were learning from me or could hope to learn from me. Am I saying that teaching doesn't have a rightful place? No. But I am saying that if you take off your teacher's hat and your specialty hat for a little bit and just inquire with your fellow human beings who just happen to be a lot younger than you, as your fellow perplexed human being, that can enrich and enhance relationships, but it can also open you up to new possibilities. Because look, okay, cosmologists are just getting with the program that these things called multiverses, or that time travels in many different ways, can regress. Guess what? Kids have been writing about this in their second grade third grade papers for years. So if we had a kid in our research office with cosmologists and particle physicists, I dare say they would come up with questions and possibilities that would actually be fodder for
Remember
for
when kids used to write their first day of school little essays, what I did over the summer, and they had this wild story and then say, and then I woke up?
Well, I don't remember.
Yes, exactly. Or just, you know, kids, some like my daughter will ask me, Daddy, am I dreaming or is this real? And you try to reassure them, no, this is real. But then you ask yourself,
well, how do you know?
How do you know?
You don't know.
Now, is that disturbing? It can be. But can it be kind of fun? Darn right.
Let's take another call or two. We have some lines open, 1-800-743-9576. Next up, it's Shauna in Lake Worth. Shauna, hi.
Hi. I wanted to just say that I agree with the author, that I think it's important for kids to have unscheduled time, that they need to be able to think their own thoughts. And modern kids really have very little time to think their own thoughts. And I think also that we're, as adults, we're constantly being told to think out of the box, think out of the box. But kids think out of the box because they haven't created the box yet.
Exactly.
And so I think your author makes a lot of really good points.
Mm. You know, that's a beautiful point. I must say that it's also important to understand, and you'll get this when you start really inquiring with kids as equals, that they share a lot of our concerns, and they just don't air it until they have an opportunity. I was holding a dialogue in Hiroshima, Japan. They're worried about what we adults are doing. They're worried about caroming from one adult-induced blunder after another, and that they don't have any say-so over that. And so I think it's important to give them an empowering sense, with I'll be Pollyannish about it, that we need to listen to them, and that their input matters and counts, and that we should incorporate it when we go about designing communities, when we go about designing foreign policy, for heaven's sakes, that we need to ask ourselves, how is this going to impact our youngest?
It's true also that, you know, for kids, they'll, you know, get it, they'll problem solve, and they'll think they've solved a problem. But when they see it's not working, they're perfectly willing to shift gears, where adults tend to get so tied into their original solution or their original idea. And that's where we run into trouble and can really learn from kids.
Right.
And as adults also, we should see teaching, the teacher as a resource, not as the driving force to teach these kids something they don't know, but an available resource for the kids to learn, because they wish to learn, they want to learn, and they never stop learning. So you don't need to force them to learn. It's just our society thinks we do.
Shauna, that's great.
Those are beautiful points. I mean, where do you learn grit, perseverance, drive? Typically not in your normal school day, even if you go through graduate school and get a PhD. But these are things that a child naturally is endowed with, more often than not, that they can lose if these qualities aren't encouraged and cultivated over time.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thanks, Shauna.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We'll move along to Delray Beach caller, Happy.
There's a Socrates
Hi.
Cafe there.
Is there
Hi.
That's right.
Yes. Hi. Hi, Happy.
There's been so many thoughts. It's a very interesting program. Thank you very much for it. But I was thinking about how society views those parents who try to give their kids that freedom and that leeway. You know, in the national news a few years ago, there was the story of someone being arrested because they allowed their kids to walk to the park. And I really try to give my kids a lot of freedom. And it's really interesting because whenever I meet someone in our neighborhood and I tell them where I live, they always say, oh, are you the one that lets their kids run around outside all the time? And I'm like, yes, that's what kids are meant to do. But it's an interesting line to walk, because especially I think here in Palm Beach County in South Florida, there is this expectation that you are planning your child's future with their college and with their dance and soccer and every city. And so when everyone's getting the summer camps lined up and I say, nope, I'm not doing anything, you know, it's a very inquisitive look that I get.
Well, I applaud you. I mean, how are we ever going to change the way things are if we don't have the chutzpah to be the change that we want to see? You really do have to buck social norms and very rigid and stilted expectations and unimaginative expectations of your fellow adults if you're going to do your kids a solid and change the way that they're brought up.
Well, and I think right before I came on air, you said something about the school and the school day. That doesn't happen. And I think that's one of the places that it's changed a lot. I know that when I was in elementary school, our recess, I mean, you know, they weren't going to let you beat down someone on the recess, but it was pretty wide open, and we just ran around and tumbled. And my child's recess is so strict. He may only play, this is my middle child who's in the third grade, he may only play with the kids in his class, and they have an assigned area of the playground. And, you know, so he doesn't get those problem-solving times where you're over there trying to build something. Or,
so we need to reinstitute and incorporate play and joy in every element of our existence. I make the argument in my book, and I point out that when Florence was at its most thriving and flourishing, and when ancient Athens was too, there was a playful element in everyday existence that's lacking today. And the thing is, it can be recaptured, but it is going to take a decided effort among those of us in the adult world who can set that example and really insist upon it.
Well, I absolutely agree. I can't wait to read the book.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for calling, Happy.
Thanks.
We're speaking with Dr. Christopher Phillips, philosopher, author, educator. His latest book is The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. Our last break, and we'll be back and take more calls and continue the conversation.
And we return as today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Christopher Phillips. His latest book, again, is The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest.
Are you more of the nurture or nature side of the debate?
Well, if a child was answering that question, he would say, why does it have to be either or?
Okay.
Because if we, the goal for me, for instance, as a parent, is to nurture those aspects of their nature that can make sure that they're creative and curious and inquisitive their whole lives long. If you see a child has maybe a tendency towards panic or anxiety and those kinds of things, maybe you have to sort of focus on redirecting that to their more creative aspects, where that almost becomes not forgotten but beside the point. I think that, so often, for instance, I write in my book about this thing that I call surplus attention order, as opposed to attention deficit disorder. I think kids have a surfeit of attention, that they're paying attention to everything, and that it's in a holistic way, not in a blurred way. And then if there's this thing called ADHD that, without oversimplifying it by any means, that quite often it's the system that we adults have created for them that bores them to tears, and that doesn't tap into their natural inclinations for inquiry and learning, and that that we put our society over the longer term, a democratic society, we can look at this in those terms, in peril, when we really don't come up with better ways to engage them, govern them, educate them, that makes them really feel part of the enterprise at a very young age.
You mentioned how these kids know everything that's going on and such a great attention, but also in emotional knowledge. They know when things are going bad. They feel it. They know it.
Sure. That's a great point. You know,
like A Death in the Family by James Agee is very poignant that way.
Yes, absolutely. My 3-year-old, she knows instantaneously when somebody has a smile plastered on their face. And she's the most outgoing social creature. She'll suddenly cower into the crook of daddy's neck because she sees that there's anger behind that person. They make these instant. There's a book called Blink, I think, by Malcolm Gladwell that talks about this. They know in the blink of an eye or less. They can tell about these things. There's emotional aptitude. It's not just instinct. It is innate, though. But again, these are things that we adults need to be attuned to when we do have kids in our orbit.
And next caller, Adi in Miami Lakes, is that correct?
Yes. How's everyone today?
Good.
I have a comment and then I have a question. I would like to circle back for a second when you guys mentioned When is it that we stop leaping and skipping? And I remember when that was. I think I was probably around 11 or 12, and I started to develop breasts. And they just felt so awkward, and I felt so weird that I said, okay, these things are just bouncing, and it's just very uncomfortable. And I just remember from that day forward, I never did that again. So I remember precisely when the day was. Mm. And the question that I have is, when we're talking about children with developmental delays and things of that nature, and I just would like Dr. Phillips' opinion on this, okay. They have a very specific way of playing. They don't play like other children should, quote-unquote, play. And often I've seen occupational therapists and ITDS, which are infant toddler developmental specialists, try to teach these children how to play. Mm-hmm. It feels so unnatural, mm-hmm. Because I have seen children just sit in a puddle of water in like a splash area at the zoo, and mm-hmm. they're just looking at a leaf or mm-hmm. looking at a snail and just splashing dirty water. Mm-hmm. And to me, that feels okay. That child is more attracted to nature. Okay. And then I see the rest of the children doing what I guess they should be doing, which is playing in the streams and the little showers and the water that's splashing around. So what do you do? How would you feel? What would you do in that instance? Like if you had a child that way, would you let him do his own instinctive way of playing, or would you... Do you think OTs are
that's
in
a beautiful
right?
That's a yeah. beautiful question. I ask in my book, what is a gifted child? So often the kids who are the most problematic, kids who are in special education programs, and my inquiries with them shine because they're given an opportunity to explore in a way that transcends or breaks the rigid bonds and expectations and criteria that in the rigid adult world constitutes a gifted child. They also tend to have a focus on things that we adults, if we walk down the street a million times, would never notice. You have a child on your shoulders or in your orbit, they'll see things that and appreciate things and bring things to your attention that you otherwise would have gone unnoticed. I think that we have to revolutionize our notion of what it is that constitutes a gifted child, to truly recognize, not just for egalitarian reasons, but what it really means to recognize every child's unique gifts and without this cookie-cutter expectation that they all have to fit into the same mold or that they should.
And next caller, Margo in Miami Beach. Margo, hi.
Hi, how are you? What I wanted to say was I think the thing I love about children so much, I have done a lot of child care with children, and the thing I love so much is about their simplicity. They're so simple, they're so easy to be with. And often I ask people, friends of mine that are having troubles, or adults, I also ask them, what was it like when you were a child? Was there something that you loved to do, something special? Was it art, or was it, you know, exploring things or something? And maybe that's something you, if you're unhappy in whatever you're doing now, maybe that's something you could look at as a possibility of doing again.
That's a really cool point. I mean, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to do is change our whole notion of what it means to be childish. Quite often when adults behave badly, we call them childish when they're just really engaging in smarmy forms of adultishness. If we were childish in the right way, well, that would mean in a very positive connotation that we're still actively engaged in and open to and inquisitive about things in a way that so many other adults aren't. So hopefully we can cultivate the best forms of childishness our whole lives long. It really might be a game changer in the direction that we're heading these days. But it gets my goat when, you know, our president and others are declared childish. A child should be insulted by that because it's nothing of the sort. They're poster children for really bad forms of adultishness.
You know, just another thought I had about this, that one of the reasons, many of the reasons that people cut themselves off from amazing possibilities within them, potentially potentially amazing is mm-hmm. first for those who have to make ends meet, that mm-hmm. they just don't have the time mm-hmm. to do that exploration and open themselves mm-hmm. up to that. And then for those who do have the time and the good fortune, they're sometimes overwhelmed by too many choices. Mm-hmm. And then another reason is a fear of the unknown and change. And then your identity may be at stake, and then a fear of failing or embarrassment.
Mm-hmm. So all I can say is if those fears are prevalent or pervasive, then take courage from observing children, because in that sense they are fearless until we instill in them that it's wrong to take stabs and guesses and explore and go into areas where we don't know the answer to. I was at the University of Miami in December, and the dean of the education department was there, and he talked about this amazing man with great humility talked about the fact that he really learned so much from his little kids, that they keep him open and honest in a way that he otherwise probably wouldn't be if it wasn't for that. And I think that there's a lot to be said for taking our cue when it comes to being worried about not knowing the answer or not peering around the curtain, that kids can show us the way.
Could you give a brief description of what I could expect if I went to a Socrates cafe?
If you went to a Socrates cafe, we would find some sort of timely and timeless philosophical question to probe into.
It's picked
by the participants. Or anybody else doesn't tell them what it's going to be. So let's say that we're in a war incursion someplace. Have we ever done that? Been in a war incursion? a typical inquiry might be, should we have U.S. troops in X country?
Should we have sent missiles to Syria?
Hammer and talks, people will go at it, yes and no, and here's why, and they don't even listen to one another. So busy screaming and convincing. At a Socrates cafe, we'll ask, well, what is a just war? Now that gives us pause, because suddenly we have to really elucidate our philosophy of what constitutes a just war. And it might well be that we bring in different incursions and conflicts as examples to support that. And it might well be that people who differ wildly politically realize they have a remarkably similar, if not identical, concept nonetheless of what constitutes a just war. That creates uncommon common ground and bonds Americans and bonds people at a time when all the rage is just divisive debate and argument. So it can be a game changer. I don't think it's an accident that we have hundreds of these groups in every kind of community. We have more groups in Florida, frankly, than anywhere else in the U.S., go figure.
Wonder why that is.
I think that there's a lot of inquisitive adults who are here. One of the great bastions of democratic inclusiveness are libraries. And if you go to our website, SocratesCafe.com, you'll see that most of these in Florida are at libraries. My favorite ones are the ones that are held in the children's section of libraries, and adults have to scrunch in those children's seats. Because then you're in their territory, and then you sort of bring things down to their level, but not in a way that dilutes, but in a way that actually gets you to explore with them and communicate with them as equals.
Well, we want to thank you. Dr. Christopher Phillips is an author, philosopher, scholar, educator, and a specialist in the Socratic method. He's the founder of the Socrates Cafe, and his latest book is The Philosophy of Childing, Unlocking Creativity, Curiosity, and Reason Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. And the website for the Socrates Cafe is SocratesCafe.com, and his blog, where he does most of his writing, is childing.org. And we want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
And so we wrap up today's edition. We hope we provoked some thoughts. Our lead producer, Richard Ives, technical direction from Michael Stock. Jason Zabka coordinates online activity. And Polly Landis is associate producer. As always, we have free audio archives of each program at our website, WLRN.org. Follow the Topical Currents link, also our iTunes podcast and the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like if you would. Tomorrow we begin with Doreen Christensen of Doreen's Deals fame. Her feature for saving money in many areas. Also, Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining, We'll visit with South Florida's king of nightlife, David Grutman. He owns and operates high-profile restaurants and clubs, including Live at the Fontainebleau and the Komodo Restaurant. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.